From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Adolf Hitler's Nazi Third Reich plundered vast quantities of art from all over Europe in World War II, theft and looting on an unimaginable scale. This week, all these years later, a priceless trove of lost Nazi-era paintings revealed in Munich. Some 1,400 works found in the apartment of the 80-year-old son of a Nazi art dealer. This hour on Point, Nazi plunder and the story of the latest amazing revelation, trove. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Can you believe this kind of priceless art, Matisse, Chagall, Picasso, is still showing up all these years later from those Nazi years? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Of course, Adolf Hitler had looked to train himself as an artist as a young man. He later led a kind of a Nazi purification campaign around art. Here was Hitler in 1933, early on, with a stadium of supporters and broadcast live over radio, saying, "In our hands alone lies the destiny of the German people." Part of that was going after art. Here's the Führer.
Liegt die Zukunft des deutschen Volkes. Wenn wir selbst...
Adolf Hitler, 1933, the crowd responds, Heil, Heil. They went after art on a massive scale. Stolen, looted, plundered. Turns out, much of it still not discovered. These pieces rediscovered. On Tuesday, Reinhard Nemitz, the German Augsburg state prosecutor, spoke about the trove of art rescued from a Munich apartment in 2011.
Hinsichtlich dieser Kunstwerke,
regarding these artworks with an ideal value so high that it cannot be estimated, there are concrete indications that this is so-called degenerate art or stolen art.
Maybe priceless, but at least a billion plus estimated as the value of what's just been revealed. With me first today from Munich, Germany, is Thomas Rohl. Thomas Rohl, he's one of the two reporters who broke the story of the newly revealed art trove for the German weekly magazine Focus. Thomas Rohl, thank you very much for being with us today. How did you learn about the existence of these paintings, sir?
Hi, Tom. Nice for having me on the show. Thank you. We can't reveal our sources, really, but we, as reporters, got a hint that something big had happened in Munich a couple of years ago already, as we learned now. And we started researching, and we tried to find out more about what had happened. We learned about the art trove that has been discovered. We didn't know much about the origin of the art. We didn't know about the owner. And during our research, which took us a couple of months, we found out what has happened and where the art was from originally.
Tell us about the art itself. How many pieces, including what artists that our listeners may know, and in what kind of condition, Thomas?
Well, they found 1,400 pieces of art, paintings, drawings, sketches, everything you can imagine, mostly modern art from early 1900, 20th century, and mostly artists from that era, so Oskar Kokoschka, Chagall, Matisse, Beckmann, all of the famous names you can imagine from that era, and those works of art were hidden in a room in an apartment in Munich. They were stored in a handmade shack, and then were stored in drawers. Mm-hmm. They were in pretty good condition. They weren't stored properly, but they weren't damaged. They were full of can I say moot? Is it
mold? Maybe
mold. Mm-hmm. Yes, but they were in a pretty good condition.
Now we respect the reporting you did to find this out, because it was not being made public. The German government had come to understand this was there some time ago. Mm-hmm. We initially heard they were hidden behind a wall, but I guess not. They were,
No. They were behind a curtain. There was a curtain, mm-hmm. and then there were drawers, and there were this kind of a shack that he has built for himself, obviously, to store the artwork. So that, no, there was no wall that has been broken. No.
This was in the apartment of an 80-year-old man, Cornelius Gurlitt, in Munich. How did he come to have all of these paintings, Thomas?
Obviously, he inherited the paintings from his father. His father was Hildebrand Gurlitt, famous German art dealer during the Nazi era. And obviously, he had acquired somehow all these works of art and has kept them in the family for more than 50 years, 70 years or more.
Tell us about his father, Hildebrand Gurlitt. This was an art collector, a man with a Jewish mother.
Yes, grandmother, Jewish grandmother.
Grandmother, excuse me. And one of a handful of art dealers we read who was commissioned by Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry to rid German museums and galleries of this art. Why did they turn to this man? What did he do for the Nazis?
Well, he was an expert on modern art. He was director of a museum in Zwickau, the post he had to give up after the Nazis came to power because he had this Jewish grandmother, and he was an avid collector of modern art. The exact art the Nazis declared degenerate afterwards, so he had to leave this post. And when the Nazis took all the artwork out of the museums, they realized they wanted to make money with these pieces of art. And then they remembered, for example, Hildebrand Gurlitt as an expert. He knew the artists, he knew the art, he knew the dealers, he knew the auction houses, and they turned to him and asked him to sell the artwork for the Nazis. And this offer he accepted. It enabled him to live rather safely in Germany. And it made him a rich man, obviously, and it allowed him to collect this vast collection of art for himself.
Now, this collection was thought to have been destroyed, I've read, along with his house during a World War II bomb attack on Dresden. He himself died in 1956. Is it known of these 1,400 newly revealed pieces? Were all of these stolen? Were they looted or not, or is it clear?
It's not clear. That's the difficult part of the story, to find out where the pieces of art come from. Many of them come from museums. They've been taken out of German museums after the Nazis declared the modern art degenerate, and then they kind of looted their own museums. And other parts of the collection are taken from Jews. For example, when the German army invaded France, they looted bank safes, that they took artworks out of houses. This is stolen art. And another part was sold by Jewish collectors during the Nazi era. They weren't allowed to, for example, lawyers weren't allowed to work anymore. They had to sell valuable stuff that they had in their possession to make their living. So this is a rather difficult collection, and it's very difficult to find out where exactly each piece has come from and what are the circumstances.
Tomas, what did the Nazis mean exactly when they said that something was degenerate art? Did it mean simply that it was modern art? Did it mean it was, in this case of paintings, painted by a Jewish artist? Or was it wider than that?
The style. Adolf Hitler and his supporters didn't like the modern style. They thought it was dangerous. It would kind of screw up people's minds. They saw it as a danger to their own power. They despised the artists. They despised the art. They said those artists didn't know how to paint. Hitler himself liked rather figural painting, simple pictures showing landscapes and
the old masters.
Yeah, the old masters.
And what about the son then of Hildebrand Gurlitt, who had these Cornelius Gurlitt in his apartment? How was it ultimately discovered that he had this gigantic trove of paintings?
This was kind of by chance. He traveled on a train from Zurich, Switzerland, to Munich, Germany, and he was approached by German customs officials, and they asked him what he has been doing in Zurich and whether he was having any money with him, because you have to know in Switzerland.
Sure, all the banks there.
Many Germans have black money in bank accounts. Mm-hmm. German officials are always suspicious when people are traveling from Zurich to Germany.
Yep.
And then he revealed 9,000 euros, and they asked him where he got the money from. And then, according to our research, he told them something about art dealings and having visited an art dealer in Zurich and collected some money, and that made them suspicious. And afterwards, they did some more research, and they found out that Cornelius Gurlitt wasn't registered with any German authority. It didn't exist in Germany officially. He had no social security number. He had no tax number.
Wow, that's very rare in Germany. It's amazing he could even get away with it.
If you pay everything cash, you can get away with it. Obviously, you can do this for more than 50 years.
Yeah. So they discovered this some years ago now. Was it 2010, 11?
Mm-hmm.
Why has it been kept unannounced all this time?
But it took them like 1.5 years to get a case against Cornelius Gurlitt, to get a search warrant for his home. It took them very long. Mm-hmm. To establish that case concerning tax evasion and customs violations. That's what the official accusation is. And then when they entered the apartment in March of 2012, and then they discovered all the art, they decided not to tell anybody because the state attorney said this is he has to respect the privacy rights of the of Mr. Gurlitt. And
wow, what about the rights of all those
informing
people?
Informing all the heirs and all the people that have interest in.
Okay.
But I think that he got that wrong, obviously.
One wonders about the rights of all those who may have lost this art back in the day, and now it sits there waiting for a disposition. Complicated case, an amazing revelation. Thomas Rawls, one of the reporters who broke the story for the German weekly magazine Focus, has joined us today from Munich, Germany. Thomas Rawls, thank you very much for being with us today. We're very grateful to you. Thanks for rolling this story out.
Thanks for having me on the show. Bye-bye.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the newly revealed trove of long undiscovered, much stolen and looted Nazi art. Word coming out of Munich, Germany this week about it. Of course, it's not news that this went on for a long time. People knew about it. There were great efforts made back in the day to recover it. There's been film treatments of this before, and there will be soon again. Here's a little bit from the 1964 film The Train, stars Burt Lancaster as French resistance member La Biche, who must stop a train loaded with stolen French masterpieces headed to Germany. Here's a scene where the museum curator, Mademoiselle Villard, played by Suzanne Flon, looks for help from the French resistance to save the artwork. La Biche has already lost a lot of men. He's unmoved.
We started with 18. Like your paintings, mademoiselle, we couldn't replace them. For certain things, we take the risk. But I won't waste lives on paintings.
But they wouldn't be wasted. Excuse me. I know that's a terrible thing to say. But those paintings are part of France. The Germans want to take them away. They've taken our land, our food. They live in our houses. And now they're trying to take our art.
From The Train, 1964. Of course, even before the war, Americans very well aware of what was going on. And American soldiers sent to try and save, recover, find a lot of this art. Here's a little bit of General Eisenhower, a speech he delivered at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. This was April 2nd, 1946. He was there to receive an honorary life fellowship for his work to preserve artwork during the Second World War.
The credit belongs to the officers and men of the combat echelons whose veneration for priceless treasures persisted, even in the heat and fears of battle. They tried within, sometimes beyond the limits of military prudence, to preserve and protect these products of man's creative instinct.
General Dwight D. Eisenhower talking right there in 1946 about that effort. It's been written about by one of our guests today. It'll soon be out in theaters early next year. The upcoming movie is The Monuments Men. It comes out in February, starring George Clooney, Matt Damon, Moore. A crew of art historians and museum curators in uniform unite to recover works of art stolen by the Nazis during World War II. Hear from the movie trailer.
The Nazis are taking everything with them, so we have to get as close to the front as we can.
Look at this. It says if Hitler dies or if Germany falls, they're to destroy everything. Everything.
We gotta move. They tell us who cares about art, but they're wrong. It is the exact reason that we're fighting. For a culture, for a way of life.
Well, what a curtain raiser for that movie, the news out of Munich in the last week. With us now from Dallas, Texas, is Robert Edsel. He's founder and president of the Monuments Men Foundation for the Preservation of Art. George Clooney directs, stars in a new film based on Robert Edsel's book, The Monuments Men, with Clooney, Matt Damon, Cate Blanchett. Comes to theaters in February. Robert Edsel's other books include Rescuing Da Vinci, Hitler and the Nazis Stole Europe's Great Art, America and Her Allies Recovered It, and Saving Italy, The Race to Rescue a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. Robert Edsel is also co-producer of the 2006 documentary film The Rape of Europa, about the theft and destruction of art during the Third Reich and Second World War. Robert Edsel in Dallas, thank you very much for being with us today.
Greetings, Tom.
Also with us from Claremont, California, is Jonathan Petropoulos, professor of European history and chair of the history department, Claremont McKenna College. He is author of The Faustian Bargain, The Art World in Nazi Germany, and of Art of Politics in the Third Reich. Jonathan Petropoulos, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you both here. Robert Edsel, what do you make of this latest revelation? Have you been assuming all along that there were still more caches of art on this scale out there somewhere?
I'm only surprised of 1,401 place. I'm not remotely surprised about the discovery. There are hundreds of thousands of missing works of art, cultural objects, documents missing from World War II. The Monuments Men found these museum directors, curators, art historians, about 70% American, 30% British, who volunteered for service during World War II. They were middle-aged, walked away from great careers. They found and ultimately returned more than 5 million stolen objects in the 6 years after the war that they were in Germany. But the job wasn't finished. The Army wanted to wrap it up and bring them home, but there were still so many things missing. And we're just now beginning to see this as the start of the tip of the iceberg. And I think our film's just going to raise public awareness off the chart.
We'll look at that Monument Men story in more detail. Jonathan Petropoulos, tell us what you know about this latest cache. Now, only a few of these images have come into the public eye yet. Listeners at our website, you can see a number of them. The images, reproductions are being shown. But Jonathan, what do we know about the makeup of this enormous cache found in Munich?
Well, this is an unfolding story thanks to the great investigative journalism of Thomas Roll and his colleagues. Mm-hmm. And clearly we don't know everything. And the reports have been changing over the past few days.
Yes.
Initially it was 1,500 paintings and now it's 14. And one precise accounting, it's 1,379 because there were 1,258 pictures out of frames and 121 in frames. Mm-hmm. So the numbers are not quite clear. We also don't have a list of the actual artworks. And many of us in the restitution field are urging the German authorities to come forward to navigate the legal obstacle, the privacy issues with Cornelius Gurlitt, and tell us exactly what works they have. They've given us a list of names, as Thomas Roll said, these classical modernist painters, and it's like a museum, Picasso and Matisse and Ernst Ludwig Kirchner. They've also told us that certain works were apparently not known previously. There's a Marc Chagall gouache that is not in the catalog raised. And there's an Otto Dix self-portrait from right after World War I that was apparently not known. But this is a developing story. I monitor the press in Europe very closely, and there are now reports that Cornelius Gurlitt had a house in Salzburg as well.
Austria.
And there may be more in Austria, exactly, over the German border. And there may be more pictures in Salzburg, and that's the expectation. So I get up every morning early, and I run to see what the reports are from Europe, and this is a very exciting development.
Robert Edsel, Cornelius Gurlitt, of course, 80 years old, the son of Hildebrand Gurlitt, who was the art dealer, one of the big art dealers that the Nazis turned to. Tell us more about him and his role, just how important it was in the movement of this enormous amount of work of art.
Well, we heard Tomas explain it, and I think he did a good job. I mean, his father is first a prominent museum director, ultimately becomes a dealer. You know, I think it's likely the monuments officers were able to determine that Gurlitt had about 160, it seems, works of art in a collection that he claimed was his. At the end of the war, the monuments officers detained him, placed him under house arrest. He was in a Schloss that had many thousands of works of art, some from German museums that had been placed there for safekeeping to keep them out of the way of Allied bombing. The monuments officers inventoried this work and began a series of interrogations with him that lasted really 6 years off and on. Part of these 5 million objects that they're going through trying to decipher to whom do they belong. We have posted on the monumentsmenfoundation.org that list, which comes from the National Archives, that has the detailed inventory list of those 160 objects, some of which, it appears about 15% of the objects were perhaps from his family, legitimately. He comes from a family of artists, and they appear to be painted by his father or grandfather. So as Jonathan said, there's a lot of information to be garnered here based on actually doing homework rather than speculation. And there's a lot of speculation that's getting out there that's causing some difficulty for all of us to understand exactly what the case is.
Jonathan Vitropoulos, take us back to the beginning of this Nazi movement to purge artworks. I mean, later on it became just outright theft and plunder, but the original motivation here, I wish you'd describe that in more detail, and when and how did that begin?
Well, within the Nazi party, within the Nazi leadership, there was a debate about modern art, actually, over expressionism. And there was a minority within the Nazi party who believed that expressionism should be accepted part of the new German Reich. Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister, initially held that position. But Hitler despised modern art. He thought it was created by people who were racially inferior and couldn't see colors as they were and shapes as they were, or they were politically subversive. They were international, they were cultural Bolsheviks, and they weren't German. And eventually, Hitler asserted himself, and in 1937, proclaimed that there was no place in the Reich for modern degenerate art and ordered a purge of German state museums. And a purging commission was created, and they went museum by museum, and they took, we now know, about 21,000 art objects out of German state museums.
Wow.
And then they started to sell them off. And Gurlitt was one of the four dealers who was commissioned to liquidate, if you will, in Nazi parlance, the modern works from German state collections.
At this point, when they were coming out of museums, that was theft from the state, you might say. When did it turn to theft from private collections?
Well, shortly thereafter, and also I should mention there was always kind of duress. Jews who in Germany who were trying to emigrate, they were put under great pressure and forced to sell their artworks, and those works have now been subject to restitution. But really, the following year, in 1938, with the invasion of Austria and the Anschluss, Viennese Jews came under attack, and there was plundering operations in Vienna after March 38, and then it continued as the Germans conquered other lands in Poland and then France and the Benelux countries and then the Soviet Union. And for what it's worth, Hildebrand Gurlitt, as Thomas Rohl and Robert Etzel indicated, mm-hmm. he became active as an art agent for Adolf Hitler and was really part of the plundering bureaucracy. And Hildebrand Gurlitt had special privileges. He had travel passes. He had access to foreign currency. He had connections to the art plundering agencies. And so he went from being a dealer of the purged modern art, which, by the way, has now been recognized, or right after the war, was recognized as a legal act on the part of a sovereign nation, the German state. And those works taken from German state collections have not been subject to restitution. But he went from that to being an agent for Hitler and the Führer Museum. And so it's quite a fascinating story, the story of Hildebrand Gurlitt. And one thing I would add, at the end of the war, he claimed that his papers were also destroyed in the bombing of Dresden. And so we've been missing a lot of the important documents to understand precisely what Gurlitt did during the war. We have some clues, but we don't know the whole story.
The Nazis were quite maniacal about ancestry. He had a Jewish grandmother. Why did that not, get him stricken from their list of people they were working with, Jonathan?
Well, if someone was useful to the Nazis, at times, they would have special arrangements, special dispensations. And in Gurlitt's case, according to the Nuremberg racial laws of 1935, he was a mixture Jew, a Mischling, a second degree, with only one Jewish grandparent. And so the Mischling, a second degree, were in a kind of gray zone. And so the fact that he was in this gray zone and the fact that he was useful both as a seller of the degenerate art with his international contacts and as an agent for Hitler and other Nazi leaders. It caused them to be pragmatic in this case and allow him to continue to work in the Third Reich.
Robert Edsel, during and after the war, did the Monument Men, the American military unit that was focused on this, did they go after Hildebrand Gurlitt? Did they have him in their sights? Did they talk with him, interrogate him?
Well, they certainly did. You know, the Monuments Men and women, it's important to point out that women were very much involved, were not just an American unit. They involved, after the countries of Europe were liberated, volunteers from some 11 other countries, a total of 13 countries. You can imagine the difficulty at the end of the war. The monuments officers have found in thousands of hiding places throughout southern Germany and into Austria caches of works of art in some places, like the Castle of Neuschwanstein, some 22,000 works of art. The Altaussee salt mine outside Salzburg, which housed so many of the works that were destined for Adolf Hitler's Führer Museum, some 7,000 paintings. And we're not talking about minor things, the Bruges Madonna by Michelangelo, the Ghent altarpiece, Vermeer's, Rembrandt's, and so on. So it's a staggering point to think about these monuments officers arriving in salt mines and caves and castles and finding these discoveries vastly in excess of anything anybody anticipated. They make the decision to move them to central collecting points, primarily in Offenbach and Wiesbaden and Munich, and they begin the process of the job falls in their laps. They're not necessarily volunteering for this, but there's nobody else to do it. And so they begin the process of trying to sort through all this material. Some of these things are so famous, it's obvious where they go. Many of them are not obvious. And over the course of 5 years, the number of monuments officers is dwindling. There's only a handful of them. The Army wants to get out of the business of restitution. And as I said, they return some 5 million objects. And by 1950, the monuments officers have that we can see off documents. There's three different prominent monuments officers that have interrogated Gurlitt during this time. One, Rose Vallon, who's the great heroine of France, who worked under the Nazis for 4 years and is a highly decorated by the United States president and also in Germany for her work. A man named Edgar Breitenbach, who was a German-born Jew that immigrated to the States and went back over as a monuments officer. And another fellow named Ted Heinrich, who's a Bronze Star recipient. All three of these people interrogated Gurlitt. And according to the rules that they had to abide by, it appeared that these 160 works, not the 1,400, but the 160 or so, which did contain some works from his family, he presented affidavits and supporting documents from third parties that indicated that these things had been in his collection and were there legitimately.
Oh, so they knew about these paintings but believed they belonged to him legitimately?
They, according to the documents that were produced, the affidavits and all of that, and at that point in time, the monuments officers were required to proceed and release these documents based on all of the affidavits. So these are part of the documents we have. There are other supporting documents that are still missing. And I don't believe this slipped through the monuments officers' hands. I think this is a matter of them following protocol sometimes when they didn't necessarily like it. But based on the evidence that they had at the point in time, you know, it appeared that these things were legitimate. Now, we're finding out that that may not be the case with all of these things. And my guess is these other works of art, the other 1,250 or so, are works that were probably acquired after the war, after he's outside the purview of military officials, as many of these Nazi art dealers did. Jonathan can certainly explain it. They went back to work and they were very, very successful art dealers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the newly revealed trove of long undiscovered, much stolen and looted Nazi art this hour. Robert Edsel is with us, author of The Monuments Men and more, George Clooney's forthcoming film of the same name, based on his book coming out early next year about Americans and others who went in during and after the war to save, rescue, find great works of art. So many had been plundered by the Nazis. He joins us from Dallas, Texas. Jonathan Petropoulos is with us from Claremont McKenna College in California, professor of European history there, author of The Faustian Bargain, The Art World in Nazi Germany, and Art as Politics in the Third Reich. Robert Edsel, also co-producer of the 2006 documentary, The Rape of Europa. And here from that documentary, Harry Ettlinger, who left Germany right after his bar mitzvah in September 1938 and returned as a monument man with the U.S. Army to protect Europe's art treasures, talked about what he saw.
Thefts were an intrinsic part of the Nazi plan to take what they valued and destroy what they didn't.
And here also from the documentary, Viennese art dealer Wolfgang Fischer recalled how three aspiring artists, Egon Schiele, Oskar Kokoschka, and 18-year-old Adolf Hitler, had applied to Austria's top art school. From the 2006 documentary, our guest Robert Edsel co-produced.
Schiele and Kokoschka were accepted, and Hitler was not. And Kokoschka always said jokingly, imagine if Hitler would have been accepted and I would have been rejected. I would have run the world quite differently, and he couldn't have done that harm that he did, being a bad painter.
Could so much have hinged on who was accepted to art school. Andrew in Providence, Rhode Island. Thank you for calling, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hello, Hi. Sir.
Hi. I'm calling with a question that immediately became two questions as I was waiting to get online. I guess the first question is, wasn't Hitler a more subtle thinker and a more subtle aesthete than we think of him as being because of this Nazi plunder of the art? I mean, I wanted to challenge the notion that Hitler didn't understand the power of the work that he had pulled out of the museums.
Well, we hear a couple of different lines of thinking on that so far in this hour. You know, one that he liked simpler paintings, another that they saw modernist art and expressionism as a threat to their whole ideology. Jonathan, what about Hitler's taste, influence, the subtlety of his thinking or aesthetics around artwork?
Well, whether Hitler was subtle or not, that's a very good question, but there's no doubt that he thought a great deal about art. We have his so-called table talk that's recorded, his monologues, which he would give late into the evening that Martin Bormann kept, and he would speak for hours and hours about art. And that's one of the fascinating things about Hitler and the Nazi leadership, that these malevolent, barbarous men cared so much about art and culture and devoted so much time to it. And in Hitler's case, I mean, he really was strident anti-modernist. He grew up in provincial Linz, Austria. There was not much of an avant-garde movement there. He found modernist circles in places like Vienna and Munich and Berlin. And Hitler, it was shaped by his experience in Linz, and he liked historicist culture, traditional academic art. And for him, he took art so seriously that, again, as subtle is a word that's difficult, but certainly he cared deeply about art. And again, that's one of the fascinating things about the Third Reich.
Our listener John writes online, I hope most of this latest trove goes on public display. John writes, I would have loved to have gone to Hitler's degenerate, quote, art show. Charles in Lexington, Kentucky. Charles, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
So we all know that, you know, it's common knowledge, Hitler, earlier days before he got into politics and everything like that, he applied several times and he was rejected for a short amount of time. He made a living just making postcards.
Charles, your line is not very good. Take us to your question, if you would.
Yes, I'm wondering why, to the guest speaker, I'm wondering why he thinks that Hitler kept these pieces of art close to destroying them since they're part of the Jewish culture, you know, the possessions of the Jews. Obviously, it's deeply intertwined, the possessions that they have with the lifestyle that they live. And so I'm presenting the question to the guest speaker, why they kept it as opposed to just completely destroyed them. Maybe Hitler's love and passion for art, as I said, he wanted to get an art school. Maybe that had more of a meaning to him than him trying to essentially take over the world.
Yeah, than you might think. Charles, let us pick it up right there. Robert Edsel, I'll bring that to you. I mean, there were a lot of books burned. We've seen it on film in the Third Reich. Why do you think that this artwork was kept rather than just destroyed?
there's this crazy thing I refer to as Nazi logic, where it only makes sense in the context of understanding the Hitler and the Nazi Party. Look, these are pragmatic people on occasion. They understand there's dollar value to it, as Jonathan said earlier. Totally right about that. But more than that, there were Torah scrolls, some 1,000 Torah scrolls piled 10 feet high that an American rabbi chaplain, Sam Bender, found, and hundreds of thousands of Jewish religious objects and library books, et cetera, which the Monuments Men found and ultimately returned. So you'd figure those are the first things that they're going to destroy. Why didn't they? Because they intended to build these racial institutes to put these things on exhibit to support in a very very pragmatic way their conviction that Jews were subhuman, and they wanted to parade the German people through and show these examples, much as they did placing the degenerate art on exhibit in these art shows to show how they'd been duped by Jewish dealers for these prices by hanging the pictures crooked and putting slogans above them. So this is all part of the use of art as a weapon of propaganda in Nazi Germany, and Adolf Hitler was a master at how to do it.
I want to go in just a moment to an attorney who's working to find restitution and recover art taken from families during World War II. One more call here first. Sarah in Fairview, Tennessee. Sarah, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a question and a comment. Mm-hmm. My comment is, this is also currently happening now in Egypt and Syria and Lebanon and Iraq. Is anyone trying to track what art could be now traveling and moving through illegal markets in those areas? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah. Jonathan Petropoulos, this may go outside your expertise, but certainly this does bring to mind, you look at the destruction of the beautiful city of Damascus in the Civil War there. Look at the museums in Iraq looted and destroyed in large part during the Iraq War. I mean, it was not only during the World War II period and the Nazi time that this kind of art and culture suffer during war, and yet there seems a different degree of focus, determination, thoroughness about the Nazi effort. Or maybe I'm wrong.
No, you're correct. I mean, the Nazis were not just extraordinary murderers. They were the greatest thieves of all time, and they plundered on an unprecedented scale. But you know, just as they are a kind of warning for us, and the Monuments Men provide a lesson, too, that we have to keep in mind, and this is one of the elements of Robert Etzel's work that's so important, reminding us how crucial the monuments were men were at the end of World War II. And we need monuments men in other parts of the world today. And when we went into Iraq earlier, we should have had a whole brigades of monuments men protecting objects from the cradle of civilization. And in all areas where there's war, combat, we need to have people who preserve our cultural patrimony. And in the wake of the damage, there are groups and organizations that are trying to redress the situation and return antiquities to Baghdad and to other places. But you know, really it's important to do at the time of the conflict. And so I think that's one aspect of Robert Etzel's work that's so important to remind us how cultural preservation is absolutely essential.
And of course, redress from the World War II era, still an unfinished project, the restitution field as you describe it. Jonathan Petropoulos, Robert Etzel, please stand by. With us right now from New York is David Rowland. He's a partner at Rowland and Petroff. They represent families hoping still to recover art taken during World War II. David Rowland, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here with this distinguished group.
Your thoughts on the new trove that has been revealed in Munich. As someone who's looking for redress, for restitution, even for recovery, how do you look at these paintings?
Well, I mean, first of all, this is a sensational find. I mean, something like this is it's almost unprecedented that something like this comes to light today. And I think the importance here is that it shines a spotlight on this issue, which is just going around the world. I mean, this is not only incredible news here in the United States, it's also incredible news in Europe. And the discussion on this is just for us who work in this field a great thing, actually.
I'm looking here at some of the images of these paintings that have surfaced. And they're very moving. This Chagall, incredible. Matisse, a woman in a posture very familiar, seated in an armchair, but dressed in a way that I'm not familiar with from Matisse. Of course, many more there. How do you know at this point, David, how it will be sorted out? The provenance, the sort of path that these paintings took to this apartment in Munich, are you confident that we will know what was taken from whom, what belonged to whom, what might have actually been a legitimate holding of the Gourlet family?
Yeah, and this, of course, is the big question. I mean, a number of our clients have been emailing me and calling me and asking me the central question here for them, which is, are there artworks in this so-called Munich hoard, this Munich stash? And that's a really good question. And, of course, we're interested. I mean, we represent about 30 to 40 families that lost art during the Nazi era. And we research those. We have art historians that work for us. We're constantly trying to find artworks like this. And, of course, it's a little bit disappointing for us to hear that so far, at least, these the authorities, I think they're the Augsburg prosecutor's office, are not willing to make a public a list of these artworks. I think they displayed about six or seven of them in a press conference the other day. And just in that press conference, one lawyer was looking at the artworks, who was looking for art for his clients, and he saw a painting. He said, oh, yeah, that's a painting we're looking for. It was a Lieberman, I think, Courses on the Beach. And he said, we've been looking for that painting, and there it is. So from our side, from what we're looking for here, and from the people who lost these artworks and their representatives, we would, of course, like them to publish a list of these artworks, also to take photographs front and back, to list the name of the artist mm-hmm. and any provenance information, and post it on the Internet so we can go and search there. Now, so far, they have said that that's not what they're going to do. They've said that we should write them letters, tell them who we represent, and tell them what art we're looking for. Now, that's a little bit impractical, because there were hundreds of thousands of artworks lost in Europe, in the Nazi era in Europe, and if everybody who lost an artwork decides to write to this Augsburg prosecutor and say, do you have my artwork, I think it'll just take, you know, forever.
On the other hand, these are incredibly valuable pieces of art. You know, it's like the situation where someone's lost a ring, and at the front desk they say, if you lost a ring, come and describe it. And we'll, if you describe it accurately, we'll give it to you. I mean, as a way of trying to vet the credibility of claims, you know, the delay in announcing this find in Munich has raised suspicions among some of our listeners right here, David. Here's Erica writes to us on Twitter. She says, the cynic in me thinks Germans are just stalling on this. Waiting for Holocaust survivors to die would reduce claims and issues. Are you that cynical about the German authorities these days on this front, David?
Well, you know, it's not that I'm cynical about these authorities. And by the way, they didn't come forward with this, as you pointed out.
Right.
It was Focus. It was Thomas mm-hmm. Roll, who mm-hmm. spoke earlier in this broadcast. And I have to take my hat off to them for their investigative work. I mean, I think that that's fantastic. But back to your question about the these particular authorities, I think what happens here is that their world, they're looking at it from their point of view in their world, which is they're prosecuting somebody with respect to a tax evasion matter, and there are privacy laws in Germany, so that they're looking at it from their sort of microscopic point of view. But we look at it from a world view. We look at it from a macro view. We look at it from the view that our clients lost this property, and I'd like to know if it's in that stash. And by the way, there's something called the Washington Conference. Jonathan Petropoulos, one of your speakers, was involved in that. And under the principles of that Washington Conference, the 46 countries have agreed that that with respect to these issues, that they will help Nazi victims try to find the artworks that they lost and also try to return it to them. So, and in Germany, which is the signatory of that agreement, there's something called the Declaration of the Federal Government, of the States, and of the Municipalities, and they've all signed on and agreed to those principles that they should help Nazi victims find any artworks that they lost and return it to them.
David, let me ask you very quickly, our time is short. Some of our listeners are asking, as all this is being worked out, is there any way all this could be displayed so that before, you know, this could take years, decades, so that the world can see this art? As
well, I think that's a wonderful idea. I mean, the easiest way to do that is that Mr. Gerlich should be found wherever he is right now, and the best thing would be for him to come forward and say, yes, I'll let people see these artworks.
Robert Edsel, the movie, The Monuments Men, with George Clooney, Matt Damon, Cate Blanchett coming out, what are Americans going to learn when they see this on the big screen, Robert?
Well, it won't be Americans. It's going to be hundreds of millions of people around the world, and that's where all the works of art are, by the way, all the missing things. Look, you asked a great question earlier. Is some listener out there have a work of art that's in Munich? The better question is, do they have it in their attic, basement, hanging on a wall, brought home by a military serviceman during the war, a displaced person? The public knows where these things are, and by raising public awareness with the film Monuments Men, we're going to be engaged, the Monuments Men Foundation, in seeking the help of the public to come forward and tell us about the things that they've got and ask us in a way that they've never been engaged before. This story is so important in helping us get there.
Well, this discovery, this revelation certainly gets it on people's minds as the movie comes toward us. Robert Edsel in Dallas, Texas, author of The Monuments Men and Rescuing Da Vinci. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Jonathan Petropoulos, author of The Faustian Bargain. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
And David Rowland at Rowland & Petroff in New York. Thanks for joining us. We're out of time. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.